The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first thing I'm going to do is to finish up a rather long article that I began last time, which is a special report on race and health in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, February 2021. You'll remember that last time I concluded with the statement that racism can act as a chronic stressor, and discrimination has been associated with poor mental health, including depressive symptoms, and poor physical health, including obesity and hypertension. Racism and other negative social determinants of health can add up to an incredible amount of stress. When you're stressed due to perceived threat, your body prompts your adrenal glands to release a surge of hormones, including adrenaline and cortisol. These hormones quicken your heart rate, raise your blood pressure, and boost your energy short term. Your body also curbs functions that would be non-essential or detrimental in a fight or flight, high stress situation. The long-term activation of the stress response system and the overexposure to cortisol and other stress hormones that follows can disrupt many of your body's processes and may lead to or increase the risk of health issues like anxiety, depression, heart disease, digestive problems, and weight gain. There are many complicating factors contributing to health disparities, but there are also nonprofits, health institutions, research centers, and other parties working to tackle these disparities from different angles. Here is what this can look like in action. Years ago, the Foundation for Black Women Wellness saw a woman in need of serious support. The woman was a single mother working multiple low-wage jobs to try to provide for her three kids. She didn't have significant family support, and her kids were on their own after school while she worked. Child Protective Services then took away her children, citing neglect. Her situation was one where she needed less systemic punishment for what appeared to be neglect, which was really stress and not having enough resources to build stability in her life for herself and her children. Peyton Care says, the mother didn't have adequate health insurance but had high blood pressure and a heart condition that was undiagnosed at the time. Heart disease is the number one killer of all women, particularly black women at young ages, Peyton Care says. So our concern was, as you're shouldering this stress of trying to work, provide for your kids, fight for them in court, how do we hold you up and keep you healthy? Over several years, the organization advocated for her in court and helped her look for better-paying jobs and access to workforce training. The woman attended the organization's programming around physical, spiritual, and financial wellness. That woman now has stable housing and living wage work and has been able to prove her ability to care for her children, Peyton Care says. The organization helped her manage and monitored health conditions for herself and her children. Her journey came full circle. She now helps the organization as a wellness ambassador to other women and young mothers. We could help her find the solutions for those very tangible, concrete things that she needed answers to: money, jobs, housing. She's on a better path now, Peyton Care says. She's now pouring her energy into other women, and that's our cycle. The Foundation for Black Women's Wellness cannot always dedicate so much time to one woman. Thus, they try to influence the whole ecosystem around black women. Peyton Kerr says, acting as advocates and speaking to city, county, and state leaders about policies, practices, and systems that affect black women and families. Within this article is another subheading, Disparities and COVID-19. Racial disparities are nothing new, but the COVID-19 pandemic has brought them to the forefront of the public's consciousness. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Black, Latino, and Native Americans have higher rates of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations compared with white Americans, and they have higher death rates. As of October 2020, Native Americans had an age-adjusted hospitalization rate 4 times higher than white Americans, and black Americans had a COVID-19 death rate twice that of whites. There are many contributing factors to these disparate outcomes. Black, Latino, and Native American people are less likely to have health insurance. Some groups of color are more likely to have various underlying health conditions like type 2 diabetes that increase the risk of severe illness with COVID-19. Many people of color have jobs that are considered essential and involve interaction with the public. According to 2018 Bureau of Labor Statistics, almost one quarter of employed Latino and Black Americans work in the service industry, compared with 16% of white workers. In addition, some groups of color more than live in multi-generational homes. These factors can make social distancing difficult. The social determinants of health can lead to health inequities, and COVID-19 illustrates that the opposite is also true. Health inequities can feed into the social determinants of health. COVID-19 is disproportionately killing Black, Latino, and Native Americans. In some cases, this means the death of the family's breadwinner, plummeting a family further into poverty, says Dr. Dubini. We've got a vicious circle, he says. Peyton Kerr saw Black women in her community laid off and furloughed due to COVID-19. This led to an immediate increase in stress and economic instability. We saw a massive number of women who were contacting us saying things like, I need help. I lost my job. I'm unemployed. I can't pay my rent this month. I can't pay the light bill. I don't know how I'm going to keep the water on. I'm stressed. I'm going to break under all this pressure, Peyton Kerr says. In an April 2020 national survey by the Pew Research Center, 61% of Latinos, 44% of Black Americans, and 38% of white Americans reported a loss of a job or wages in their household as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Dubini hopes that health disparities remain in the public consciousness even after COVID-19 has faded away. He argues that the pandemic has shown us that ignoring disparities harms our collective social interests. All of us have seen businesses that closed, communities that are essentially decimated, Dr. Dubini says. The health of a neighbor is also our health, and if we don't pay attention to it, ultimately it will come to affect all of us. Now I'm going to turn to an article from the Harvard Health Letter of March 2021. And this article is entitled, Over-the-Counter Hearing Aids, Are They Ready Yet? They're not yet FDA approved, but the devices are available and safe if you know what to look for. When Congress passed the Over-the-Counter Hearing Aid Act in 2017, It opened up a new world of possibility for people with hearing loss. Instead of paying $5,000 for a pair of FDA-approved hearing aids and follow-up service, you could pay hundreds of dollars for an over-the-counter pair from any seller. No doctor's appointments, no hearing tests, no fittings needed. The devices would have the same fundamental technology as traditional hearing aids and would be targeted to people with perceived mild to moderate hearing loss. And the FDA would ensure quality by regulating and approving the OTC devices. But now it's been 4 years, and the OTC hearing aid category and its safety and labeling rules are still tied up in red tape. That doesn't mean the gadgets don't exist. They're available online and in some stores or healthcare practices. But the devices are unregulated and unapproved. And you need to carefully navigate this category of hearing devices because you can't always be sure what kind of quality you're getting. What are the gadgets? Until the FDA created a new over-the-counter category, any sound amplifier that's not an FDA-approved prescription hearing aid was considered a personal sound amplification product. The FDA said PSAPs, that's personal sound amplification product, are appropriate only for people with normal hearing who want to boost sounds in certain situations, like bird watching or listening to lecturers. And initially, that's about all PSAPs were good for. They were clunky, over-the-ear sound amplifiers with short battery lives and minimal features. They had a one-size-fits-all setting and couldn't remove unwanted sounds. These problems are largely gone because technology has evolved. Like the more expensive hearing aids, many PSAPs are small devices placed inside your ear. You can customize settings for your needs and usually modify them using a smartphone. PSAPs aren't allowed to be called hearing aids, but in some cases the technical differences are very subtle, says Kevin Frank, until recently the director of audiology at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. What's the catch? Skipping a hearing test and simply buying a pair of PSAPs comes with certain risks. For example, without a hearing test, you won't know what's causing your hearing problem. Maybe it's wax buildup. Maybe it's a tumor. And not all types of hearing problems are solved by amplification. Some PSAPs promise helpful features, but are of poor quality and non-returnable. High-tech PSAPs can be hard to use, controlled by complicated smartphone apps. Despite these caveats, some clinicians consider PSAPs solid alternatives for people with mild to moderate hearing loss, as long as you know what to look for. Frank suggests PSAPs with easy-to-use controls and apps, customer service to help you figure out how to operate the device, and a money-back guarantee with a 60-day return window. Other features that Frank recommends include customization. Make sure you can adjust the gain for your ears. Gain is the volume in specific regions of hearing, like high-pitched versus low-pitched, where you need it. If you've had a professional hearing test called an audiogram, you may also be able to type in the results, Frank says. Several microphones. You need standard microphones which pick up all sounds, and also directional microphones which focus on sounds in front of you. Great for when you're having a conversation. Noise cancellation. Look for technology that filters out unwanted sounds like the wind, loud background noise, or some of your own voice. You want PSAPs that make your voice sound less boomy to you when you're speaking. If you wear earplugs, you know how loud that voice can sound. Comfort. Professionally dispensed hearing aids can be molded to your ear to fit perfectly. You won't get that kind of fit with a PSAP, but you can find models with memory foam or several sizes of silicone tips. And if the PSAPs are uncomfortable, send them back. You can find PSAPs online or sold by healthcare professionals and organizations. Consider getting a PSAP from a local audiologist or a hospital group that's already researched the option and can teach you how to use the device, Frank suggests. Until we have standard quality measures, that's the safest way to go. Now I'm going to turn to a section called News Briefs in the Harvard Health Letter of March 2021. The first section is Control High Blood Pressure to Protect Memory and Thinking Skills. Here's more incentive to keep your blood pressure under control. A large study published online December 14, 2020 by the journal Hypertension suggests that high blood pressure hastens decline in cognitive ability or thinking skills. Researchers analyzed two health assessments taken about 4 years apart of more than 7,000 middle-aged and older people in Brazil. The assessment noted changes in a number of cognitive skills, like memory, language, and concentration. Regardless of age, people with high blood pressure had faster declines in cognitive performance compared with people who had normal blood pressure. The researchers classified blood pressure as high if the top number was 130 or higher and the bottom number was 80 or higher. But even people with a top number between 120 and 130 experienced faster cognitive decline than people with normal blood pressure. The silver lining, the researchers found that treating high blood pressure at any age appeared to reduce or prevent accelerated cognitive decline. High blood pressure can be controlled with medication, as well as pill-free approaches, like losing weight, exercising, eating a heart-healthy diet, reducing alcohol intake, managing stress, and quitting smoking. Take a deep breath before adopting new asthma guidelines. Hold off before you follow new recommendations to treat mild persistent asthma, or at least consult your doctor first. The updated guidelines from the National Institute of Health published online in the December 2020 issue of the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology say it's okay for people with mild persistent asthma to stop daily use of inhaled corticosteroids and instead use them only as needed, along with short-acting beta agonists, so-called rescue medications. That's considered a major shift in guidance, but that may not be a good idea for some older adults, says Dr. Anna Wolfson, an allergist and immunologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. A lot of people have a harder time with the occasional use of medications than a routine practice of daily use, she says, and you may not want to decrease your asthma regimen during the pandemic. Poorly controlled asthma could lead to a flare or an ER visit, and perhaps an increased risk for complications if you develop COVID-19. Dr. Wolfson says there are some people who might benefit from using inhaled corticosteroids only as needed, but she urges you to speak with your doctor before changing your medication regimen. Can a tracker or smartphone app help you move more? Wearing activity or fitness trackers and smartphone apps are helpful for goal setting and measuring how many steps you take or how much time you spend exercising. But do they motivate you to become more active? Probably a little, finds a review of randomized control trials published online in the December 21, 2020 British Journal of Sports Medicine. Researchers combed through 28 studies that included a total of more than 7,400 adults ages 18 to 65 who used fitness trackers or apps for an average of 3 months. Compared with people who did not use the device, people who did increased their activity by 1,850 steps per day. Apps and trackers that included prompts and cues to stay active appeared to be the most effective. If your smartphone doesn't already have a built-in basic fitness tracker that counts your steps and calories burned, you can find an app that does. Some are free. Fancy tracking devices with all the bells and whistles, including heart rate monitors and cell phone capability, cost as much as $1,300. But even the simplest ones help remind you to move. Now I'm going to turn back to the special report of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter about race and health and turn to a subject of clinical research. The goal of clinical research is to advance medicine to help people live longer and healthier lives. But all too often, not enough people of color are included in clinical research trials. Consider cancer research in 2019. Only 4% of the 3,593 clinical trial participants for 11 new cancer drugs were black, and 5% were Latino, according to the FDA. To compare, black people and Latinos are 13% and 19% of the U.S. population. Another study found that only 13 of over 70,000 participants in 145 cancer drug trials were Native American. Donald Northfelt, MD, a Mayo Clinic medical oncologist and Arizona site director of Mayo Clinic's Center for Health Equity and Community Engagement Research, says that this underrepresentation is a problem. The purpose of cancer clinical trials is to show us the best way to treat people with cancer, Dr. Northfelt says. But there is a big difference in the way that people from different backgrounds experience their cancers. What works in a group of Caucasian women isn't necessarily going to lead to the same outcome for someone who lives remotely on a reservation or has trouble understanding directions given by her care team because her care team doesn't speak Spanish, or a black woman with diabetes and high blood pressure that she hasn't been able to get controlled adequately because of unconscious bias and racial disparities in her health care, he says. Including diverse populations in clinical trials helps researchers get closer to understanding the true value and true harm of a cancer intervention, Dr. Northfelt says. Additionally, it's important that people have equitable access to the innovative approaches offered in clinical trials. But minority groups may face unique barriers to participating in clinical trials. They may have less access to or less awareness of trials, or face transportation barriers or worries about costs. These are real challenges for Native American tribes near the Mayo Clinic in Arizona. Those living on a remote part of the reservation may not have any cellular service in their homes, or they may have limited means and periodically run out of money for gas, Dr. Northfelt says. These factors can make contacting and coordinating with patients more logistically challenging. While these are not insurmountable barriers, These require understanding and workarounds in order to keep people engaged in clinical trials, he says. Through an existing partnership with the Phoenix Indian Medical Center, Mayo Clinic has joined in the work of overcoming these obstacles. For over a decade, the Mayo Clinic has provided weekly in-person oncology and hematology consultative services at PIMC, working in partnership with PIMC doctors, providing cancer care. Today, if Mayo Clinic doctors identify people at PIMC who are eligible for a clinical trial at the Mayo Clinic, they're invited to participate. As a result, Native American participation in Mayo Clinic's Arizona campus clinical trials increased from 0.9% in 2019 to 5% in 2020. These are encouraging results. But Dr. Northfelt and the Centers for Health Equity and Community Engagement Research in Arizona want to further strengthen connections between local tribes and the Mayo Clinic. We see some of their patients, but I think we could do a lot better at opening the doors of Mayo Clinic to patients from these local tribes, he says. Is there something we could do to make Mayo Clinic in Arizona a more welcoming place for our Native neighbors? That's going to make Mayo a more diverse place than it currently is. Clinical care. Properly managing your diabetes can be a lot of work. Now imagine you don't have health insurance or the extra income to buy healthy food options or a membership to a gym for exercise. Perhaps it's difficult to research diabetes management on your own because you only have a few years of schooling or you can't read or write at all. It's a very complex disease, says Christina Flood Erdegaren, Community Health Outreach Manager at St. Mary's Health Clinic in St. Paul. All of these things make it even more complex. St. Mary's saw 1,700 patients in its last fiscal year, 99% of whom are Latino. The vast majority speak Spanish. They don't have health insurance and live within 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. In 2020, that was an annual income of $25,000 or $52,000 for a family of four. The clinic staff, with the help of many volunteers, are a ministry of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet and run completely on philanthropy, grants, and donations. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I sure hope you enjoyed it.